I'm Charis Santilli. I was born with ambition. My parents were entrepreneurs, and I pushed myself to be high school valedictorian, class president, most artistic, and most likely to succeed. The summer I turned 19, we celebrated my dad's 50th birthday with a hot air balloon ride. A crash landing left him with a broken neck, me with a broken heart, and my mom coping through alcohol. My relentless ambition helped me become a successful entrepreneur, yet my own private paralysis and overachiever addiction ruled me. I finally ventured on a quest for my best life. I found the path of my inner peace, how to stay on it, and how to show the way for others. Now it's your turn. Ready to take that load off your shoulders? Join me so you can cherish your life. Today is an absolute joy. I get to have on here with me today, Rick Hale. He is truly the epitome of a modern day Renaissance man. And apparently he's been told that before. And that is exactly how I introduced him to someone recently. And he's an entrepreneur. He's an author. He's a musician. He's an artist. He is also an avid boater and fisherman. He's constantly open to new things. He's become a client of mine who I've had the pleasure of supporting. We have had some fabulous conversations, and he has a podcast as well. It's been fun to hear him share forward some of the ideas, things that were sparked out of some of our conversations. And now he's also becoming a friend, and I am thrilled about the fact that in a couple of weeks, I finally get to meet this man in person because, you know, this digital time we live in, we can get to know someone really well over Zoom and calls and then realize that we've never actually met in person. And I get to actually see you, Rick, soon. I am so excited for that.
Yes, as am I.
Great. It's going to be so fun. And I'm going to get to go out on that beautiful boat of his, hopefully weather providing. So it's going to be super fun. So Rick, as I mentioned, Rick is an author, and his first book, Stop Settling, that I'm showing up on the screen if you're watching the video version. I wanted to, you know, we're going to start off talking a bit about that. Rick, you have a passion for building businesses and leading organizations. You also, I know, have a deep desire within, in connection with that and beyond, to teach people, to inspire people. And oh, also, I didn't mention you're also a speaker and a consultant and a coach in your own right, in your own way. Yeah. So you share your life and business experiences in your book that I just showed called Stop Settling, Finding Clear Directions for a Regret-Free Life. I first of all want to ask you, what was the moment that inspired you to write the book? Was, you know, was there a specific moment, or what led up to that as far as something actually prompting you to get out the pen and paper, get out the keyboard or whatever it was, and start working on it?
Yeah. So it started, like most ideas, not the way it ended up. My first thought was, frankly, my father's father's father. If you go back 2, 3, 4 generations, I just have no frame of reference to what their life was like. And, you know, at one point my father was starting to age and he started sharing stories that he'd never shared. And I found it incredibly inspiring and interesting. And I thought, man, how cool would it have been if, you know, 4 generations back, 5, 6, you know, a few hundred years, heck, I mean, what would it look like? You know, what was your best day? What was your worst day like? What, you know, it doesn't have to, I'm not thinking, you know, in terms of everyone writing a book necessarily, but what if you left letters or a journal for your successors? And so I, you know, being an introspective guy, I guess I then flipped the script on it. Well, what would it look like if I started that ritual for our family and that my kids decide to do the same? And the more I pondered the idea of leaving a legacy letter, the more I realized that, you know, we're all authors in this life that we live. You know, you're authoring your experience every day. And either it's a page in the book that you keep or a page that you tear out. And most people think, you know, being an author is actually publishing a book. I believe it's actually crafting the stories and the experiences and then finding meaning inside of those. And so that's sort of the evolution of my thinking. And then as I started writing things down, I started paying more attention to life and my experiences. And I also started bringing up stories and, you know, rewinding the tape and analyzing, like, what was the impact of certain things in my life? And what was the lesson learned or the opportunity? And if I were to leave nuggets of wisdom and experiential humor and, you know, tragedy even, and also the highs and the lows, what would, you know, what would I want to convey in that story? And the interesting thing, Cheris, is the reticular activator is a part of the brain that connects dots, and the subconscious brain is a riddle solver. And so the riddle I gave it was, what about me would be worthy of leaving in a letter, a story, a journal, or ultimately a book? And so the byproduct of that decision to leave a journal or a you know, letters was, I started to pay attention to things that mattered. And my reticular activator, which is like when you decide you want to, let's say you want an Acura Legend or a car, all of a sudden, all you see is that car. Like, your subconscious brain just went to work solving it. And the riddle for me was, how do I live my best life and do it in a way that's worthy of sharing those stories? And I want to share that message to everyone, because everyone's an author. And so what stories can you craft and create going forward, and which in the past are worthy of retelling? Because it'll shape the way you see things. And, you know, the way you see things, you know, if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And so that's sort of that's a long version of why I decided to write a book. But it started out short and small and sweet, and next thing you know, at 300 pages, I had to stop writing, for at least for this book.
Well, funny, you know, I literally brought up the reticular activating system in our brain on a solo podcast episode just a couple of weeks ago that dropped. So interesting timing to have that brought up. And because I don't think I've specifically talked about it, and no guest has up until this point, but yeah, it's right. Pretty powerful stuff. And so what I also know about you and your book, you talk about, and you really look at the power of long-term thinking and making sure and finding ways to have your past not negatively affect, like, especially challenging and tragic and traumatic experiences of our past, whether they're day-to-day traumas or bigger traumas, you know, having those not have a negative impact on our lives and our future. And mm-hmm. you have really done a lot of work in that area to make sure that didn't happen. And you even started that really at a young age, from what you share in the book and what I know about you too. And in the book, you share very candidly, very openly about challenges that you faced during your childhood. I mean, throughout your whole life, but especially your childhood, and how those challenges shaped your journey and your life to date. And so I definitely would love for you to touch on whatever key points you'd like to share about your story with our listeners today, so that they get a sense of you. And not only some of the key points, but how were you able to transform those things so that they, you know, and I love the concept of transmutation too, right? So that they could turn into something that could have knocked you down. Like, well, right. Maybe they did knock you down, but could have completely knocked you down or kept you down. But that you used as, I want to say, almost more like as gas or fuel for your journey, you know, to keep you moving forward, and how those came into be. So please do share.
Yeah. So fundamentally, I believe that trauma, tragedy, failure can all be translated or transferred into a superpower. And I'm living proof of that. I mean, there was a time as a child, I mean, just to preface a little bit, there's the entire first chapter is really kind of here's how it happened in terms of 0 to 25 years old for me. And I went to 10 schools in 12 years. My parents were married and divorced to different people 4 different times. I've lived with different iterations of family. I've lived with, in 7th and 8th grade, I lived with a Polish immigrant family who weren't even my family. I went to Massachusetts for 2 years by some, you know, there's a movie, Lemony Snicket, Snickets, you know, series of unfortunate events that ultimately proved fortunate. And you just don't know. There's also a story that's fun about a man who inherits a horse. And, you know, it goes, you know, he loses the horse and then the horse brings other horses back and then his son breaks his leg on the horse. The long story short of that is it could be good, it could be bad. Who knows? It's just part of the story. But in my story, in you know, 10 schools in 12 years, I learned some real lessons, but I also had a lot of heartbreak. You know, having my biological mother move away when I was 10 and diagnosed with cancer and supposed, you know, timeline for death was inside of a year. And then getting sent to a military boarding school for a year where I was incredibly lonely, crying myself to sleep most days, you know, followed by, again, time in Massachusetts with another surrogate family of sort. And my stepfather then was an incredibly loving, kind person, but ended up having to serve time in prison because of some corporate crimes that he was charged of. And that ended that stint. And then I lived with an abusive grandfather for a year and a half, only to be sent to Venezuela, which, by the way, when my mother left at 10, diagnosed with cancer, she ran to Venezuela to live with her family at the time there just to escape, and ended up marrying a Venezuelan and didn't come back. And so at 16, I got to really meet my mom again for the first time in a long time. And most people take a gap year off from college. I was blessed to get mine halfway through 10th grade. Didn't even get to wait for summer. And but the gift in that, or the silver lining, which is almost what I titled the book, by the way. I at one point I was like, holy cow, these are all things perceived horrible that actually turned out to really shape my worldview and my ability to help others and be more relatable to people that have had challenging situations. And that's a gift. And back to the superpower, mindset of superpowers. But in that year in Venezuela, I would say of all the stories in the book, the one that probably shaped me the most was when a Venezuelan missionary came to our little village. And my mom didn't live in the cool part of, you know, Caracas or somewhere in a city. We were in the middle of nowhere. And when I say nowhere, deep, deep into Venezuela, near Colombia, Andes Mountains, it was beautiful and majestic, but incredibly lonely for a 16-year-old who, you know, I thrive on, you know, people and opportunities to go out and do what 16-year-olds like to do in the United States. And it was all snatched away. Oxen roaming the field was like reality. They didn't even have motorized, you know, equipment for farming. But all that to say, at one point when I was there, just hanging out, trying to figure it out, a missionary came to our village and he asked my mom if I could travel with him. And my mother, I don't know how much thought she put into it, but her immediate response was yes, because I'm pretty sure we were at odds and I was a little angry and probably, we had spent a long time apart and we were trying to figure it out. And I was 16 and probably a little feisty, and she was feisty in her own right. And she said, sure, take him with you. And in a moment of lack of clarity in my mind, I agreed because I just thought anywhere is better than here. I jumped into this guy's motorhome. It really was a converted box truck with two bunk beds and a projection screen that he would reverse engineer. He would open up the side, drop a screen down. He went village to village and he would preach the gospel. And the lens inside the box truck was a reverse lens, so that what you saw outside was right ways. And it was a bizarre reality. But here's the comical part, Jairus. I get in the truck, I look over at him and I'm like, hey man, where are we going? You know, this is going to be an adventure. And here's what I hear. And I'm like, shikes, what the heck did he just say? And I went, okay, where are we going after that? He didn't speak a word of English. My mom failed to share that data point. I didn't speak. I mean, I think my Spanish was limited to cerveza and baño. Like, I knew two words. And I spent 6 weeks with this guy. And the lesson, the silver lining was that, you know, one, you can overcome anything when you have to, not a want to. I had to. It was non-negotiable for me to figure out how to communicate and get along. Number two, I recognized something in him I'd never seen in another human being. It was pure passion. It was absolute commitment to something. His heart led, it was a heart led mission, and God was his mission. And every day he woke up with it, every day he went to sleep with it. And he was the most passionate person I'd ever seen. And I don't know how old he was, but I'm going to guess he was 30 or 30 and change. And at 16, everyone feels old, but looking back at it, you know, I'm almost 60 now. He was a young guy committed to his path. And it was so inspiring to see that. And the last thing was, we were in these towns where I mean, we had no AC, like it was hot. And if someone invited us in and I slept on a hammock with an electric fan blowing, it's like I wanted to stick my face in it and just go, make that noise you make into a fan. It was like a night at the Ritz. And I realized my absolute worst day was someone's best day somewhere. And that I was blessed even at my lowest point. And, you know, reflecting back, there were days I didn't feel capable of being loved. And I'm very unlovable, very uncertain, very insecure, abandonment issues, just the things that go with a lot of turbulence as a kid and not having a stable environment, not having stable people around me. And I also realized that there are powers bigger than me that are going to pull me through. And so watching him and his belief in spirituality combined with passion, I came back to the United States after that year. You know, most people want to kiss the ground. They talk about that, you know, immigrant mentality of how the land of milk and honey and opportunity. I didn't want to just kiss the ground, man. I wanted to eat a bowl of the dirt. I would have, with a grin on my face. Like at that point at 16, I knew that I could be having do anything if I applied myself. And the story goes on from there. There's a few more turns and twists and a day from going to a children's home next because I couldn't find a place to live and didn't ultimately have to. But it really carved out my perspective of what opportunity looks like. And it also shaped the way I see the human experience.
Yeah, it's quite a story. And he's not kidding when he says twists and turns. I mean, talk about a turbulent is the word coming to mind here. Turbulent childhood. A lot of changes, a serious lack of consistency, a serious lack of stability in the people in your life, in the location where you lived, all of these things, and friendships too, because you were just constantly moving around. And yet you were able to somehow make sure that that didn't turn you into, it just seems like it could have been the perfect storm and enabled you to become a very different person than the person you became. Like, you know, a lot of great excuses for all sorts of ways you could have ended up living. I mean, even on the street or into all kinds of trouble, and yet you didn't. And you ultimately built a bit of a real estate empire. And along the way, didn't lose sight of dreams and things for passions you had, such as music. I mean, you've been part of a band and still are again, or, you know, there's just all these things that you didn't lose sight of. And from everything I've learned too, you enjoyed the process of building your real estate empire. At the same time, I know that there's some things that it cost you too. So, you know, let's dive into kind of that. So you had this turbulent childhood. Somehow through all these twists and turns, you are able to, you know, become what America would coin as a successful man, a successful businessman by, you know, typical success terms that would typically equate to financial freedom. But I know that you have a broader sense of the concept of success. And so talk about that for a minute. You know, how has that definition come about for you, changed for you? I'm sure it may have even been different when you were in the crux of building things versus where you're at right now. So, and I know that that's a key topic for many people that I work with. And my audience is a bit of redefining that and making sure that we aren't getting sucked into it just being all about the monetary reward and the achievement.
Yeah. Well, I was really blessed to find real estate as an industry when I was 30. And I kind of goofed around in my 20s, to your point, pursued art, went to art school and music school, learned to, you know, record and write music. Had a business degree from Georgia State to go with it. But at 30, I realized that I couldn't figure out how to unlock the key to music and business and create a path to wealth building and enough, you know, again, my definition of wealth financially is $1 more than you need to live the life that you choose in passive income. that's real wealth, because then you're given, you've given yourself the opportunity for margin and not having to show up for a job one day and then fulfill your real promise that hopefully your higher power, or your sense of purpose delivers. As I've evolved into it, you know, in a, I guess a more mature adult, I think success is more about significance. And the gift of real estate for me was, at first, you know, consulting people was just my favorite thing to do. Talk about wealth building and life enhancement. And, you know, what is it like for you and your family to live in this home or to transition to a new area and, you know, these schools and this social infrastructure and this life experience. And as time went on, I realized I really like coaching and training. And so the opportunity to open up franchises for the Keller Williams company came about, and I seized it, you know, with all my heart and energy and kind of the same passion that Johnny pursued evangelism in Venezuela. I pursued building brokerages. And what was interesting is I learned the better I was at serving holistic human beings, like all of your needs and wants and goals, and less about just how to, you know, X's and O's of purchase and sale agreements. And, you know, this is a sales strategy, a tactic, or a script. You know, those are all important elements when you're growing and learning how to communicate effectively and to build a business. Ultimately, it doesn't always lead to success. I've seen people make a ton of money and lose everything in terms of family, their kids, and disconnect from health. And so as I've matured, I realized that's a real empty victory, you know? So if making money is not the hardest part of the equation, I think significance is the bigger puzzle to put together. And so part of the book, there's a couple of chapters in here where I address, what does it look like to bite off bigger bites, bigger pieces of life and bigger goals that don't happen inside of a year that, and I've broken down, I've created this thing called a wheel of life. I should say I've modified it. There are no new ideas, by the way. It's just repackaged in your story, which goes back to you being the author. Your story, someone needs your story right now. And it doesn't matter if the data point is a repurposed data point, because again, where someone is in that moment is where they need to potentially hear it. But for me, I figured out there's 12 key categories in life. Zig Ziglar had 7, and in the process of hiring people for our companies, I had a dozen or so. The bigger question is, where do you want to be in 5 years? Because if I understood the holistic view of you and where you're going, and I serve you in that capacity, retention gets easy. You know, I learned something early on too, Cherish, that people don't quit companies, they quit people. And as it's a scary thought, because it's also very personal when someone leaves your industry or your company. But I translated that to mean, if I love you with all my heart and understand you with all my heart and head, I'm a better counselor, guide, you know, I can guide you. I can be the compass. I can counterbalance when you get out of balance, your perspective. And that's all anyone wants, is to have a big, full life. And so, but if you don't know what that looks like, you can't really serve someone. And the more often I hired, and often I wouldn't hire, because they'd wake up going, hey, this isn't, after the process of, you know, the hiring process, they'd say, I'm not supposed to be here. This doesn't really serve me long-term. And then they'd find what they really want. And I would walk away feeling so fulfilled, a little bit disappointed if I thought they were awesome and hoping they'd join our team, but awesome that, you know, I could be authentic and loving and kind and let them be the version of them they need to be somewhere else. But the more I did it, the more I realized this is really a story for me to fill in the blanks for. And so I created this 5-year future self workshop. It's a half a day workshop, and it's probably the most meaningful thing I do, because it's so holistic in approach, and it attacks everything in life that might be that hole or that area of regret one day. And that whole, you know, the idea that significance lies in not having, you know, having the fewest amount of regret. And so by taking into account all 12 categories, it's hard to wake up disappointed in your trajectory or your potential.
And I love that, I often will go there with people too about their future self. And I love, like, my favorite award, you know, in Hollywood, acceptance sheet speech was by Matthew McConaughey, you know, talking about who he chases, and it's his future self, and it's always his future self. And I think it's, that can be such a guiding light. I personally will think about my own future self at times of like, okay, what's the best thing for me? Sometimes I'll even go to the extreme future self of, okay, future self on deathbed, you know, and just even picture what if that's 6 months from now. I made some decisions that way, like just pretend I don't have warning. That's the time. But I like sometimes with certain decisions, I like to think of a shorter window, because then it's like, well, dang, what would I have? And I look back on what would I have regretted? And as you put in your tagline of your book, a regret-free life, you know, that just totally like targets me quickly too.
Yeah.
Well, heck, in 6 months, I would have regretted A or B or C. So that means therefore I should do D here, you know, okay, let's do it. And trust that me imagining that future version of me is helping to guide me in the right path.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the concept of and the practice of letting your future self guide you.
Well, and success is usually a metric defined on a KPI or a spreadsheet or some data point, where to me, holistic success is really that significance piece, which is really the lives you touch and the people that you bring along with you. And it's winning with and through people, and it's having meaningful, rewarding relationships, so that on my last day, it's not about a spreadsheet that I'm clutching. It's really the hearts and minds and experiences and the stories that are to be retold, because they have, you know, real lasting meaning.
Regardless of what the heck happens after we leave here and whatever anybody believes or doesn't believe, I think we all clearly see that you don't get to take the stuff with you.
That's a fact.
So, you know, if there's anything that goes with you, it'll be the experiences, the growth, the love, the stuff that's inside your memories and or consciousness or whatever you want to call all that too. But, I think that's one thing that probably most of us can agree upon.
Yeah.
So,
and it's not an excuse not to take action and not to double down. And, you know, there's a thing called counterbalance, where some seasons in life, when you're accomplishing, you know, working towards an accomplishment that's significant, sometimes you do have to park a few of your ancillary things on the wheel of life. But the key is not to leave them there to the extent that they become a detriment or a cancer or irrevocably harmed. And so that's the message in the book, really, is you can't have it all, and you may not be perfectly balanced. In fact, you'll rarely be perfectly balanced, but the awareness piece keeps you in check long enough to reel those back in while you actually do extraordinary things that require hyper-focus.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if we rewind a little bit before you got into your more focused time, you start off the book with a little story when you were 26, because you told us about the kind of you bookmarked and talked about the first 25 years. But this is interesting to me that you talk about how your stepfather told you you were, quote, that you had a distinct lack of failure in your life. And it was also interesting because he touched on, you know, some points here, but if you read Rick's that whole first section that talks about his experiences, I mean, he also could have positioned it and said, you had a lot of failures. Look, you haven't been able to have, you know, a stable life here yet. So tell us about why he said that you had a distinct lack of failure, and then what that sparked in you, because I think it's a really interesting, and you chose to open the book with that sentence. So tell us more.
I did. And it was a pivotal moment, because I was, like you said, I think I was 25 or 26. And at that point, I already owned my own house. I was doing what they call house hacking today, which is like a thing. I've got a friend who wrote an entire book just on that. And that's where you rent out rooms and you basically sublet your house, and almost like a version of a bed and breakfast, and you cover all of your mortgage. And I was 25. And, you know, I think I bought my house when I was 24, in fact. And it was a legitimate, you know, 4-bedroom, 3-bath. I had an in-ground pool, for gosh sakes. And I was doing okay, but I was in a corporate job that was safe and stable. I was, you know, I grew my hair long. I was having this Pied Piper fun life, you know, trying to make it in music. And to his credit, he recognized that every decision I was making was really inside of a box of safety. And that real life lives in a bigger paradigm, in a bigger world. And he opened the lens of, hey, play the what if game. You know, what if you could be, have, and do anything like you think you say you are, but you're really playing it safe. And it was in that moment that you said, you know, you suffer a distinct lack of failure. And to be honest, in that moment, I was offended by the statement because I played the, you know, but wait, look at the spreadsheet. I've got a motorcycle, a Jeep, I own a house, I'm in a band, you know, I've got a solid job that pays well. I'm a, you know, middle-level manager running sales teams at Cox Enterprises. And the scorecard for my age looked good. And he made it clear that it was a self-induced relative scorecard to myself and not to my potential. So I was benchmarking the world and people around me who were underachieving versus my real capacity. And so I parlayed that into a renewed attitude a few years later when I took on a career full, you know, straight commission in real estate sales, and then parlayed that into opening brokerages in my early 30s when I knew nothing about running companies. And I didn't, sales training and management, those are things I thought I would enjoy and embrace. But at the time, I was terrified. I mean, the what if game sounds great when it's all optimistic, but what if I can't? What if I don't? What if I'm not? What if, you know, fill in the blank? And so I had to embrace that risk. And on the other side of that becomes a better version of you that becomes the new norm. And that was his point. You're really not testing. You're not in that. The whole concept of failing forward came to light as well, that people don't learn doing what they've always done if they've done it well and it comes easy. You only learn when you challenge and you reach and you start to grow in ways that are uncomfortable. And I had to get comfortable being uncomfortable.
And you definitely did, because I know that you're a guy who likes to, you know, you make bold choices. You're a risk taker and you are a go for it. You know, that's the way you live. Yeah. And you also are all about seeking out true freedom that is, as you've already expressed, beyond and really different than financial freedom, because as you've said, you know, there's plenty of people who have made a lot of money and yet are freaking miserable and don't have quality relationships or actual enjoyment in anything in their life, continuing to chase. So
what's
these,
it all for?
Yeah. Because that just, and you know, and I'm working with people that are at a certain phase of life, as you know, cause you know, some other clients of mine that are, making sure that they're finding that fulfillment that is not just in that, well, like you said, empty victory moments. You said something about an empty victory just a little while ago, because we're all going after these achievements, or have been, and then there reaches this time, typically tending to be late 40s to into the 60s, that are we're wanting to make sure that we have this like lasting fulfillment, like true satisfaction that's not just a blip in this moment of ta-da, got the thing, and then what's next. And I know that that's something that you are continuing to look at and challenge some of the stories, the programming, the cultural programming, and the habitual way of thinking about that. So, you know, how do you counter that to make sure that you don't get caught in that cycle of that continuing to, it's one thing to make bold choices and have fun and seek out the freedom, but if you're constantly chasing all of this stuff and you don't ever enjoy it, which I know you have been, you know, truly living and enjoying your life. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit too, but you know, what do you think has been one of the keys for you in that sense?
I think one of the greatest gifts I ever gave myself was, understanding the book by Miguel Ruiz. It's The Four Agreements. Mm-hmm. And the agreements are be impeccable with your word. So I've always worked really hard to speak with clarity and with passion and purpose. The others, don't take things personally. When someone else acts out or acts up or does something harmful, it's real easy to think that you had a play in it, a cause in it. And part of that was how I healed my childhood. You know, I had to go back and spend a few years, you know, bouncing in and out of, you know, different therapist's office just to get my head around my part in all of the horrible things that, you know, that ended up not being horrible. They ended up being awesome, because that's what shaped my worldview and what gave me context and content to go help other people who've suffered on some level. And the other was, don't make assumptions, which is a really good mantra to live by, because it's real easy when someone behaves in a certain way to assume that, you know, the source of that frustration, anger, you know, whatever their emotional energy. And the last one is just do your best. And, you know, by adopting that energy, I started to embrace stress differently. I also began to realize that hurting people hurt, and that I, by virtue of that realization, I could assign empathy and sympathy and love to people who possibly don't deserve it or aren't exhibiting behavior that feels deserving in the environment in that moment. And by doing that, I became less defensive and I became a better listener. And I could, again, connect the dots for them better and mitigate all of the conflict almost immediately. It's amazing how fast you can disarm somebody. So the point is, how do you operate under stress and trauma, and one bite at a time, one moment at a time, not letting it consume you? And also the realization that if I can't fix, solve, or cure it, I'm going to give it away. I'm going to meditate about it. I'm going to do my best to, trust me, I'm a pleaser, which, you know, there are people out there right now going, I got to win them all. And I'm here to tell you, you can't win them all. Winning them all is sometimes loving them from where they are and not accepting and absorbing their energy. And that's, I think, how you build a big organization with inherent chaos that comes from big. And, you know, our group's got 1500 agents and 60 or so employees, and they did 3 billion in volume and like 10,000 plus homes last year in sales. And I just pinch myself that it gets to be me. And so another lesson is nothing happens fast. It's slow and then it's sudden. All of a sudden you wake up on top of the mountain, not realizing you'd been climbing for 4 or 5 years, 10 years. And part of the book, again, is that whole reality that if you expect everything to happen in 30 days, 60 days, or inside of a year, it's a recipe, in my opinion, for disappointment. Because the really, really big goals require a crock pot, not a microwave. They just take time. And you have to keep feeding that animal until one day it grows into something beautiful. And that's how I kind of got there with my real estate business. And then the byproduct was my interpersonal skill and capacity to connect and lead people. And that happened small. And then it, you know, one person at a time over time. And then one day I woke up on the other side going, man, the greatest gift is to win with people. And, you know, if you're the average of the 3 to 5, 7, 10 people you spend your most time with, I'd hit a home run with some of the people in my world that I could bring along with this joyous journey. And today I sit here 3.5 years removed from my official role in the organization, able to do this with you today and not worry about compliance and brokerage stuff. And passive income supports the lifestyle I've chosen. And then I can, you know, my prayers, God, give me the wisdom and the courage to act on it. And I've created enough margin that I can say yes to things that don't show up on a spreadsheet. And I think that's the ultimate gift to yourself and the universe. If you do the right, you plant the right seeds and you fertilize and nurture relationships in a productive way.
And then you recognize when those things show up and then that you actually say yes and you don't just keep your head down.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard because your ego, you become that the title, the role, the experience, the mountains you've built or climbed or, you know, with it, that on some level becomes you and change. I don't care where you are in life. Change is scary. I mean, it's fear-based, just about everything. And you know this better than anybody. And you've taught and trained and reinforced this for years. And with me, you know, what part of this is fear-based? And as much as an active, successful or perceived successful adult, I'm only successful in the rear view. Going forward, tomorrow's another day. And I have no idea if I'm going to win the day. I'm committed to it. And I'm up for any challenge. And I'm most okay to fail forward and get it done. But no one really knows. But how you embrace it and how you move into that, it really changes everything. So to your credit, your mission and message is really helpful. And, you know, I don't care where you are, fear will dictate your next step.
Well, awesome segue, because I did want to ask you, I know from your book and from what you just shared and from my working with you, that you are a firm believer in asking for support, seeking out support, and getting the support and influence of coaches and mentors of all types. And as people can hear you speaking, I mean, Rick, you're so well spoken. You've clearly got your act together. You've done amazing things. You're continuing to do amazing things. And yet here you are. You were willing and open to coach with me when a mutual friend introduced us last year, even though you're a coach and consultant in your own right, and yet you were like, yeah, let me talk to her as you were going through a bit of a, you know, a phase of your transition. So, you know, what initially motivated you to consider coaching with me when we met? I mean, like I said, you clearly have a lot together, but what was the driving force at that moment?
Well, a number of things. One, I was going through a life change, and I don't think you can see in yourself what others can, especially if they're skilled and emotionally evolved and mature. And that's something you possess and something that I needed. I just needed a mirror that was more accurate than a static mirror in my bathroom, if you will, because there's complexity and depth in the words and the tone and the energy that only a really in tune person can pick up on. And at this point in life, and anybody that's listening that's had some success realizes next level success usually isn't a quantum leap. At some point you've got the formula dialed and you're knocking down, you know, tactical opportunities and you're going and growing. But that quantum leap's probably one tiny shift or one small, you know, left or right turn instead of straight that really does change everything. And so I knew I needed some self-awareness around the things that were enabling and disabling what my next chapter might look like. And someone who, you know, you unbiased and third party, and you're, you know, my wife's awesome and my kids are awesome, but they're more inclined to, you know, tell me I'm great and support. They're not quite as candid, I guess, for lack of a better word. And I think, you know, loving candidness is a gift from somebody that you trust and respect. And that's what you brought. And I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. It's been my honor, privilege to work with you. And I know I remember even in the very first session, I think I even mentioned the concept of, I could tell already we were going to be getting into nuances, you and I,
right. And
we always did. I mean, every call is typically around some nuances. And, but in those, like you said, were some big nuggets, you know, that in the tiniest bits, or me catching just one phrasing or one word or one something, to mirror back to you and say, hey, you just said this, you know, are you aware of that? Did, you know, what does that mean to you? What do you want to be saying or thinking that? So how about you share with us, you know, one key insight or, you know, some kind of breakthrough you experienced during our sessions? I mean, I remember first one you had during our very first session, but something that sticks in your mind that you'd love to share.
So there are a couple things, and the first one I'll just keep brief, but it's just awareness around the sensitivity I have for my father, and he's starting to show age, and it's just weird when, you know, I won't say roles reverse, but all of a sudden the relationship evolves differently as people become older and vulnerabilities start to show up. And so I really didn't know how to deal with it because I'd always seen him as this Adonis capable of, you know, conquering, you know, I was just chasing a shadow. And so the conversation just became different, and you helped me sort of get clear in how to approach sensitive conversations. And that was really helpful because that's uncharted territory. The other was just my own self, because as an achiever, it's really hard not to achieve. Like that's what, when you hang your hat and you define yourself as something, and you know, you've got the cape with an S on it, you know, there's like, oh, I'm that guy. And then all of a sudden you wake up, you're like, am I that guy? Like, does this season require it? Or is it, you know, is it choice or chance that's going to dictate the next steps and the next mountain I'm going to climb? And I also wake up with this sense of every day has got to have like definable significance, which I think is a gift, but it's also a curse. And at some point in life, the real revelations and real self-awareness comes from spaced interval, time and margin. And you helped me get clear, you know, instead of going for it, which was always my mantra, I'm going to go, you know, just go for it. In fact, I love the Ben Franklin quote, and that guy was ridiculously successful and productive, inventor, scholar, statesman, ridiculous, one of the greatest to ever walk around on our planet. And they, when asked how he did what he did, he said, I bit off more than I could chew, and I chewed like hell. And that's been me. And all of a sudden I'm like, what if I didn't bite off more than I could chew? I bit off what I wanted to chew. And then I was more selective about what I bit off. And then instead of thinking in terms of I also believe that there's quality in the quantity. Like you throw enough darts, you're going to hit the target. what if I was more strategic and threw fewer darts at fewer things and became more specific and strategic? And that just took, I had to drop the car from fourth gear to second, first and second gear, and just slow it down long enough to see what I'm running past, to make sure that I didn't miss any mile markers that mattered. And I think the word that we came up with that you helped me with was, you know, flow for it instead of go for it. And to be honest, being okay, like accepting that today's going to be a day with my dad on a boat fishing for 6 hours. And when I get back, I'm going to take a really nice nap. And when I get up, I'm going to write a few notes in my journal about what it meant and how I can apply that to that holistic version of me that I'm still fighting for that matters.
Yeah.
Because that's not the me of the past. The me of the past would be guilt-ridden. I'd stress about all the people I let down, including myself. I'm not the role model I want all the people in my economic paradigm and my companies to live by. And you know what? Just be okay being okay for a season. And so I've given myself permission. And I don't know that I could have done it without you. So for that, I'm grateful.
Well, thank you. And that is one of the biggest things. I mean, I had to learn that myself, and I still do. I mean, I practice what I preach. I am constantly, I am so grateful for what I do because I get to hear myself say words that I need to hear back to me to remind myself and reinforce everything I'm working through and continuing to evolve with. And permission for myself. You've talked about it here for you and pretty much everybody that I work with. Permission to like really live the life we want to live at this moment in time. Permission to have it change tomorrow. Permission to have it change next month or next year. Permission to say what we really want and have it be different than what it was 10 years ago and be okay with that. You know, all of that is so big. It's so big. And I remember you telling me too that, you know, what I provided and what I provide is more perspective coaching. You know, a lot of people are typically used to coaches that are all about performance. And I am so not that. I mean, I'm all about how you're performing in your life, like literally to like feel better in your life, but it's really about perspective. And I'm giving you permission to have your life be whatever is enjoyable to you right now. And it's okay to slow down if that's fitting you. And for most of us, that really is a really great way to go and figure out how to set down the checklist of, you know, checking the things off and the gotta do these. I remember one day we were talking and you made a comment about really wanting to make an impact, just, you know, wanting to like making sure you're making an impact in people's lives. And then we just realized what an impact you'd made on the prior day, taking a lovely group of people out on your boat, and how, I mean, they were so excited. It was a lifetime experience moment that they will never forget. And to even show you, look, you were having fun out on your boat and making a huge impact. And I remember you kind of looking at me like, oh yeah, I did that. Yeah. That was hugely impactful for that group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a big deal. I mean,
and some of it's that whole smell the roses mentality. Like there's so many magical moments that we just run past because we're running at 1,000 miles an hour. And then the other realization is that, you know, and I've kind of grown up teaching the mindset or a concept of the 80-20 rule, that 20% of what you do creates 80% of the results and outcome. That applies to business, but it also applies to life. Like if you equally weight every moment and behavior as if you'll end up doing things that are unnecessary and could be either subcontracted, outsourced, or leveraged. And then, you know, my goal right now, again, it's more of a quality over quantity thing. And, and being present. That's somebody that anybody listening right now that has trouble setting their phone down or disconnecting, or it's hard. It's a practiced behavior, and I'm working on it. And that's another benefit, I think, in our conversations. After every conversation, I would, one, feel better and acknowledge myself for the little things that, you know, don't show up on a spreadsheet, but then also set my compass for more of those things that matter, and that, you know, things are only good for the things they do, and money's only good for the good that it does. And so, you know, just finished a book called Die with Zero, and I doubt I'm going to die with zero, but it could happen. It would be okay. You don't take it with you. There's another book called, you know, It All Goes Back in the Box. Sobering reality around, you know, so what's your eulogy read like? And it's more about conversations that matter, being present when they matter, being available to people that need you, that matter, and then honoring that inner voice that probably isn't a rat race voice.
Yeah, it's all so important. You mentioned a compass, and that happens to be holding up his book again, on the cover of your book. And I love talking about how we all have an inner compass, an internal compass. And interesting, and too, I know that our coaching experience also circled around and looped back in with a connection with your book. So how did that come together for you? Like literally coaching sessions and the time and some of the philosophies kind of, I'm going to say maybe reconnected you with some of the your own themes in your life and the messages in your book. So I'd love to hear you talk about that for a bit.
Well, a short version of the answer would just be that we've all heard the saying, the cobbler's kids who don't have shoes. And so it's really easy to prescribe it. And, you know, prescription without proper diagnosis is malpractice. So one aspect is to analyze reality and then make changes based on that reality. And it's really easy through the external lens of other people, especially if you're thought provoked and analytical and you're kind of paying attention. But sometimes, man, you get caught up in your own way and habit, and without that mirror, if you will, back to the mirror concept, that you helped me mirror a lot of what I, and some of it wasn't all like, hey, you know, you say this, but are we in integrity? And, you know, I define integrity as when your inside voice and thoughts align with your outward behavior, you know, and I think of it more in terms of your greatness, not the detriment, because there's two voices we all have. One that says, you know, that whole voice of doubt and uncertainty, but then there's this voice that says you really are capable of almost anything. If it's to be, why not me, is one of my favorite sayings. And it was my affirmation for years. If it's to be, why not me? And then I would follow it with, you know, God, give me the wisdom and the courage to act on it. We all have just ridiculous amounts of wisdom. The courage piece is the hard part and the actual act on it part. So the compass idea, I think, was that whole inner voice conversation as opposed to tactical and strategic, and a little less tactical and strategic, and a little more what moves your heart, what moves your soul, what gives you validity, what gives you sense of meaning and purpose, and a reminder that, you know, not only is there room for all of us to grow, but there's also room for acknowledgement and the things that we've done well so far, so that you love yourself more, because you can't give away what you don't have. And self-love is the greatest gift.
Absolutely. So a couple things in closing. First of all, what would you say is a key takeaway that you want people to get from your book?
Number one would just be that you're worthy of anything you choose to pursue. And I genuinely believe it. It helps when your core gifts and skills are aligned. But in that same vein, that if you align yourself with people who counterbalance those gifts, if you don't have a certain gift and you find people who are committed to your mission, you can augment and, you know, support. You can still achieve anything you want. You can be, have, and do. I don't know, you know, most people are connected to our country and capacity, but I think you can be, have, and do anything if you put in the work and you find the right role models. And, you know, if you do what they do, you should be able to get what they get if that's what you want. And then the silver lining of all of that is that as you evolve in that mission, you know, pay attention to all categories of life and realize that some things don't happen inside of a year. And I think we're all prone to quitting. It's easy to, and most people, I will say, so I'll qualify that by saying most people don't wholesale quit, like who are achievers and motivated. They suit up, show up, do what they can, and then they may or may not reach fulfillment. But to me, micro quitting is a concept that I kind of talk about in the book too. And that's when you just default on what you know you're supposed to do right now because the compass inside you says do it. It's like stopping a stranger and giving them a word of encouragement, or being expressing, you know, a disproportionate interest in somebody who may or may not, you know, deserve it. It's listening to that voice that just says, I'm supposed to do this. This is the moment of, and, but we walk or run right past it. So awareness. And the bigger message is, again, back to the 5-year plan. I think if you craft a 5-year plan and you post and publish it in a poster like setting or some way that has shelf life, that doesn't get lost in a stack of, you know, notes from motivational speakers over the years. I think if you just let things percolate over time, the universe wants you to have what you want to have. You just have to stay omni-aware and listen closely and then take action when the moment of truth and that sonar lights up inside your body. So it's 5-year bites, and it's having a bigger picture, and it's also taking into account all 12 categories. The ultimate message in it is, how do you live a regret-free life? And that's, you know, to me, it's not leaving relationships harmed and damaged, and it's making the most out of experiences with people.
And as I've told you, and I'll share with everyone here and say to you again, you truly are the living embodiment of this book. I mean, I recognize you wrote it and it is about you and your experiences, but it's a lot about concepts and philosophies and ways of living. And you take people through exercises too. I mean, there's a lot packed in here, and you really have lived the way that you've sought out and that you advise for people. You truly are the embodiment of the book. And I think that's truly beautiful. I mean, you are living a regret-free life. I know that you're practicing that. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I've just truly adore talking with you. I love our conversations, love supporting you. And I am so excited to have been able to share you with my audience. And if anybody is wants to connect, well, first of all, there'll be a link in the show notes with to his website, rickhale.com, rickhale.com. And, you know, highly recommend the book. It's quite a story and some great suggestions and tools in there. And I mean, there's investment tips that, like, you cover the gamut. There's, if you can't find a gem in here to make it worth your time, I will be shocked. So, right. Any other parting words about that? And also, you know, closing quote on your mind, would love to, you know, anything else you want to say?
Yeah. So just realize the source of this content was really, I wanted to one day have an impact and mentor my own kids long after I'm gone. And so it's really an operations manual for what I think a life well lived and worth living looks like. And your kind words, you know, Zig Ziglar said it once, how do you know when someone needs encouragement? And the answer is they're breathing. And so your encouragement has always been invaluable to me, as is, you know, kindness is currency to me. And that's what I want people to grasp, is that life's short, make the most of it, live by a plan. That doesn't mean underachieve, in fact, overachieve, but do it strategically and by design, and make sure that you don't leave any pieces and parts behind that later cause you pain and regret. And if you pull that off, man, your eulogy writes itself. It absolutely writes itself. So, you know, I guess my parting thought is, if adopt the mantra, if it's to be, why not me? But then get really clear what that version of you, that ultimate best, looks like, and then fight for that opportunity to grow into that person.
Love it. And I am so excited to be able to give you a big hug soon in real life.
Can't wait.
Okay. Signing off for now, everyone. And I'll see you soon, Rick Hale.
Yep. See you, Cherish. Thanks. You're the best.
I hope you're enjoying my Cherish Your Life podcast. If this is supporting you in any way, please review, subscribe, and share it with friends and family. You can follow me on social media at Cherish Your Life, and my website is cherishyourlife.com. Yep, my name's unique. Here's an easy tip for you to pronounce and spell it. It's like the city Paris, but with a CH. Special thanks to my dear friend Paul Suyelgis, who enhanced and mixed the musical track. Little did we know back in college in the 90s, while my then boyfriend, now husband, and I listened to Paul riff on his guitar, that he'd be helping me decades later give a creative touch to something called a podcast.